the Porcupine filament, which are fine bolts. A Mellotron does not really closely give you enough tact to get the filament right on the money. What I did was what this guy in West Virginia did. I called Simpler Sales in Nebraska. I got a 2-amp, 0-120 in, 0-132 volt out variac. I mounted it on the back of the amplifier, and the filament transformer is a 220 volt transformer. So what I did was I took one side of the line, put that to the white, to the high side of the variac, put the 120 volt variac to neutral, the other side, which is chassis ground, and the wiper goes to the transformer. Now I get smooth, very smooth up and down on the filament voltage. I double checked it with the Simpson 260 and a digital meter. As near as I can see on a 4-volt filament for the last couple of years, it was running around 4.3 or 4.4 volts. I can now vary it from 0 up to about 5.9. So I set it with the Simpson, double checked it with the digital meter. I have it sitting right at 5 volts. What I also did was I put two jacks, two binding posts on the RF deck connected right to the filament. So now you can, I can just hook a meter right across there with the P24, crank the filament to 5 volts. Back to that, it's 2 EL.
Yeah, it's good you checked that, Rich. Transmitting tubes are very critical to filament voltage. The good news, if you put too low a filament voltage, is the filament itself will last longer. The bad news is that the cathode is going to be unhappy when you do that. A well-designed cathode on a transmitting tube has all kinds of exotic metals in there that are supposed to bubble up to the surface at just the right rate. For them to bubble up at the right rate to give you the right life of the cathode and the right emitting area of the cathode, it takes the right cathode temperature, which requires the right voltage. So if a transmitter manufacturer tells you to use 5 volts plus or minus a couple of percent, it's worth the extra effort to make that happen for the life of the tube and the full performance of the tube. And the 4.3 that you had there before is definitely out of spec on the low side. And yeah, it's saving your filament, but it's not saving your cathode. And it's good you made that change. And it's good thing. You've got to write an article about this whole saga of you making all these modifications that amplifier, Rich. Think about writing it all down and submitting it, because guaranteed there are other people out there that would like to do what you've done with that rather popular amplifier. Okay, let's go over to Paul. I hope we haven't put you to sleep, Paul, and tell us what's going on in space. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet. I thought Paul was there earlier. Maybe we put him to sleep. And maybe he got called away. And if so, have I skipped anybody so far, as far as their questions, their comments, their answers, and whatever? And in theory, Ken Burns has got his beautiful program being played for the first time on PBS tonight called The War, meaning World War II. We probably lost some of our audience to that. It's a very highly rated program. Anybody want to make any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, there being none. Let's see if Mel's got some further comments about all of the things he's involved in. El Presidente of the Kings County Radio Club. What's on your plate today, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WATCDL with one comment.
Hold on there, Mel. Go ahead, Andy.
I just turned the radio on, but I was listening earlier. You mind if I just mention something about diodes and the problems that they can create under abnormal conditions?
Go for it, because that's the subject that Lou had us discussing for quite a bit of length. Go ahead.
I know I was listening. Here's one for the books I can write about. Because as you know, I do repair work on amateur radio equipment. And I get a call from a guy, and he says that his Yaesu, I think it's a 1000D. This was about a year or two ago. And I forget if it's the 1000D or the 1000MP, one or the other. Anyway, he said all of a sudden, he's hearing some strange noises on his receiver. And it's all over the band. And he's not making any contacts. He says he can't transmit. So I get the radio and I listen to it, and sure enough, I hear these birdies and oscillations all over the place, on every band, 10 meters, 20, 40, 15, 80, and so on. I go to transmit, and I see that the power that's coming out is only about 20 watts. And I say, okay, well, we've got two separate problems here. We've got a low power transmit condition, and we got this crazy receiver condition. Anyway, to make a long story short, it turned out to be something very simple. One transistor. And I'll tell you what it does. In this particular radio, they use a pin diode for switching. And what happened was the transistor that turns on the pin diode, the transistor is either on or off, but it decided to become leak. And under the leaking conditions, it just happened to bias the pin diode just right, so the pin diode was a square wave generator. I was generating square waves throughout the whole band. As soon as I bypassed the pin diode switch, the power, the output power, came back to normal. That was the first clue. Bypassing the pin diode switch, because I saw that the power amplifier was working normally, but there was no power coming out. One transistor that controls that circuit, that pin diode, is all the problem turned out to be, just for that. So the rule is, even with pin diodes in these modern radios, sometimes you got to be careful, because the diodes themselves, if they're biased a certain way, can generate all these square waves. Back to you, Dick.
Interesting to know. Yep, and pin diodes themselves, when they're halfway between the on and the off mode, they really are a diode. A very slow, sloppy diode, but they're a diode. And they're going to give you all the harmonic generation and square waves and whatever that you mentioned. So the good news about modern-day rigs is that the pin diode transmit-receive relay-like function is a solid-state relay, and it switches in microseconds. That's the good news, as opposed to an electromechanical relay, which switches in 20 milliseconds. The bad news is that the pin diode switches are a little bit more lossy than the electromechanical. They're nice and compact, they're fast and acting, but they're a little bit more lost, and if they're not being fed just right, the right voltages at the right time, they have to be fed the right amount of voltage in the transmit mode and the right amount of voltage in the receive mode. And if not, that can give you some pretty weird results, because they're intended to be full on and full off and not in between. Very similar to what happens to a logic T squared L integrated circuit. By the definition of T squared L, anything less than 9/10 of a volt is a hard zero. Anything greater than 2.4 volts is a hard one. In between 9/10 and 2.4 volts is no man's land. If for some reason your integrated circuit starts putting out digital signals that dwell for any significant length of time in the vicinity of plus 9/10 of a volt to plus 2.4 volts, the no man's land, the switching of your logic downrange is now very questionable. I did a test today of a Hewlett-Packard signal generator, and I found out that when you're using it in the external AM modulation mode, where you're trying to turn the signal generator on and off with, say, pulses, that it does its transition switching at almost exactly 1.5 volts, but no man's land. So as you're putting a pulse, a rising, you're going to have a nice ramp voltage of the pulse going in, a repetitive pulse train, going into the Hewlett-Packard signal generator. I wish I could remember the model number. is the one that goes to about 3 gigs and goes down to around 10 megs. Nice, very nice signal generator, very popular. And I was looking at it with a dual channel scope, a 300 megacycle scope, and I was looking at the RF output on one channel, I was looking at the T squared L logic that I was firing it with the other channel. And when I figured out where it actually does its transition, it was doing it at 1.5 ohms. So knowing that allows me to figure out a little bit more about the timing and what's really happening when I'm using that particular signal generator. Anyone with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW-TechNet.
Dick, this is WA2ARQ with a question about an RF amplifier.
N2CRV.
Okay, ARQ and CRV in that order. Mr. ARQ, start off with your name, sir, and then your comment or question.
Yeah, WA2ARQ here. Handle is Vic, Victor Wright, and Charlie. I have a question about RF amplifiers as far as, let's say, the Ameritrons. I know that there's a couple of models of Ameritrons with the 811s. One's got three in them, which has 600 watts, and the other one is four. Tubes with 800 watts. The 811s, of course, are rated at about 200 watts each. I'm just wondering what the difference is, why we don't see power amplifiers and push-pull RF amplifiers linear. I guess it's because of the way the tubes are biased, or is it the point at which the tube is cut off, and if you could please give me a quick explanation of which would give you more power, whether it would be in parallel or the difference between push-pull and just parallel.
Okay, a transmitting tube usually is rated for a certain amount of D-plus voltage on each of its terminals, a certain amount of bias voltage, a certain amount of drive power, and when it sees the right impedance, it will, if the tube is working correctly, if it's in good shape, produce the power that the manufacturer told you about. The main thing that determines what power the tube produces is it getting the right drive, the right voltage, does it see the right impedance at resonance on its output circuit. So, if someone asks you, within the laws of physics, do you get more power out of push-pull or out of parallel? The answer is there is no difference. If you set up the circuit correctly, I, for one, am a very strong advocate of parallel tubes. When it comes to UHF, the main reason that push-pull was created is because in the early days of UHF circuits, if you put tubes in parallel, you've got twice the amount of plate capacitance. To make a good plate circuit resonator working at twice the amount of capacitance in the early days before they discovered all the benefits of a very wide strip line, making the inductance low enough to resonate with that capacitance used to be very difficult. And so therefore, there was a very popular opinion around 1970 saying that at UHF frequencies, multiple tubes must be used in push-pull. And along comes some character called K2RIW, who thinks he invented something called a parallel kilowatt amplifier, a pair of 4CX250Bs in parallel. He submits that article to Ham Radio Magazine, and Jim Fisk said, hey, who is this nut who put tubes at a UHF frequency in parallel when everyone knows they got to be push-pull? He considered the article a nut paper, he rejected it, he mailed it back to me. At that time, multiple people following my instructions, listening to me on the air, getting schematics from me, mailed to them by snail mail, as we didn't know about it, but that's what it was in those days. Multiple people are building the parallel kilowatt amplifier. By the time I resubmitted the article, this time to QST Magazine instead of AM Radio, there's probably about 20 of these amplifiers on the air. And it wasn't Doug DeMore. I'm trying to think of who's the inventor of World Above 50 Meg. My goodness, my W1, why can't I think of his call letters name?
No, that's okay. I know the article in QST. Let me see if I got it.
Yeah, so he recognized the article, and it got published, and from then on, Jim Fisk apologized to me almost every year, saying, please send us another article. I'm sorry, I rejected that one. Anyhow, so push-pull or parallel, if you're smart enough, there is no advantage of one over the other as far as efficiency and power output is concerned. Now, when it comes to simplicity of circuit, parallel in general is a lot simpler than push-pull. So I'm a strong advocate of parallel, as you can tell. Back to you, sir.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dick. I really appreciate it. I saw it, I mean, back from my audio experimentation back 40 years ago, it seemed to me that it was about the same amount of power out, whether it was parallel or push-pull. But there again, you're talking about Class A amplifiers as opposed to Class Cs and yada, yada, yada. I really appreciate it. I thought it might be something to do with the way the tube was biased or the cutoff the cutoff time of the tube to make it work as a Class C amplifier. I thank you for your time, and of course, those Ameritron 811s 3 and 4 tube configurations. As you say, it must be easier because they're, both of those units are in parallel. So there has to be some sort of simplicity in that. I thank you very much for your time, and I don't know the next station to get it, who is also in the queue. This is WA2ARQ off clear, QRC and listening out. Dick, thanks again for your expert advice.
Okay, Vic. In the case of audio amplifiers, there's a huge advantage in running the push-pull, because a push-pull center tap transformer is way away from any iron saturation characteristic. If you ran the two tubes in parallel to one side of a transformer, you would be saturating the transformer with the tube current, the plate current, and unless you're willing to invest in a whole lot of iron, you're going to be into a whole lot of trouble. On top of that, in the case of audio, push-pull tends to give you cancellation of, I think it's an even harmonic. So there's a lot of advantage in push-pull when it comes to audio. But when it comes to RF circuits, where you resonate the living daylights out of the plate, by that I mean that you take the plate capacitance and you connect it to this tank circuit, which really is, if you analyze it correctly, a huge flywheel. And so the tube is just pushing an arm into a flywheel, like the push rod on the wheels of a steam locomotive, if you know what I mean. And so the flywheel is what dominates. And whether the tubes are doing it in parallel or push-pull makes not very much difference. And parallel is circuit-wise a hell of a lot simpler, and therefore a lot of people favor it. And with modern-day circuits, you can carry that all the way up into UHF frequencies. Part of what gave me the gumption to build a parallel circuit in 1970 is I was studying the 2N512, I think it was. There was a RCA power transistor rated at something like 5 watts, or maybe it was 10 watts. And if you studied what's inside the transistor, it had something like 50 individual devices all running in parallel at UHF frequencies. And so I reasoned, if they can do it with transistors, why the heck can't I do it with tubes? I did, and except for that controversy when I first submitted the article, after that it worked reasonably well. Mr. CRV, I think it is, W2CRV, or some call letters similar to that, start off with your name, sir, and your question or comment. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
All right, name is Alan. And the prefix is November, November 2. I was back to the double stubs on the page 60. Appears to have an error in the X of C, for the stub line. Not a tangent, it's supposed to be there, it's supposed to be the cotangent.
You gotta be careful now. Cotangent is what you use with an open circuit. Tangent is what you use with a shorted stub. So an open stub is cotangent. A shorted stub is tangent. Does that make some sense, Alan?
Well, I think the text says the capacitive reactance of an open stub is Z0 tan, should be cotan right there in the text.
I haven't studied it yet. You brought it to my attention. I'm going to study it. I'm going to go slowly and see what he's really saying. And when in doubt, in the case of a shorted stub, you know that when you make the length of the line shorter and shorter in wavelength, the inductive reactance becomes smaller and smaller. When it's an open circuited stub and you make it shorter and shorter, the capacitive reactance gets higher and higher. So it becomes a small capacitor when it's an open circuit stub. When you make it very short, it becomes a very small inductor when you've got a shorter stub and you make it very short. So once you know the direction it's got to go, there's a good way you can test whether or not it should be tangent or cotangent and whether or not the formula is working correctly. You've also got to be a little bit careful about what happens when you go to multiple quarter wavelengths. Depending on how your particular trigonometry function works in your particular calculator, you can sometimes come up with some slightly crazy answers. Most calculators, when calculating inverse sine, inverse cosine, and inverse tangent, will only cover two quadrants of the total circle, and they don't cover the other two quadrants when you're doing the inverse function. So there are times when that'll get you in trouble. You have to know that there's that limitation built into most of our handheld calculators. So I will check this over, Alan, and although I think it's a darn good article, let's hope there isn't an error. N2CRV, K2RIW.
All right, fine, Dick. Just a slight second comment is this article used an inductor and a capacitor, but surely you could replace it with what you've been talking about, the quarter wave length shorted line. And I haven't thought of the difference between the two situations, one producing a tuned circuit, and the other one is also similar. I don't know whether you've thought that through, whether two pieces at each eighth of the wavelength.
Okay, two pieces of coax cable, one short and one open, each an eighth of a wavelength long. I'm going to double stud and check this, but I think that makes a LC resonator, parallel resonator equivalent. And so that's a tuned circuit if you do it correctly. And that at times can be very handy to make sure that only the right frequency gets to your preamp, we'll say for instance, and make sure that all other frequencies don't, and to make sure that the input line to your preamp is being DC grounded so it's not building up a static charge that can definitely give you trouble. You'd be amazed how many guys will study their preamp and they say, gee, the first thing going into my preamp is a coupling capacitor. Therefore, the DC voltage won't go there and everything's hunky-dory. You better stop right there. Because depending on how your antenna is set up, Mother Nature can supply many thousands of volts of static charge on your antenna on a dry winter day with the wind blowing over it. And those many thousands of volts will eventually arc over that little coupling capacitor in your preamp. And when it happens, there's no doubt about it, you're going to get damaged, that poor little gas set. The good news about some of these super low noise gas sets is that they can get extremely low noise figure compared to what we used to be able to do, let's say 20 years ago. That's the good news. The bad news is it takes very few microjoules of stored energy delivered to that gate of effect to make it into a useless hunk of gallium arsenide. Back to you if you want to have any further comments on this hour. K2RIW.
WB2HWW, two comments.
Howie recognized, or your audio is loud. Stand by, Howie. Alan first. Go ahead, Alan.
Okay, no, I'm done. The major thing was to point out the, what I believe is an error in the text, before, since everybody's looking at it. And I checked it up in the AWRL handbook, which sort of confirmed that it is wrong in the on page 60. So back to you, Dick. Thanks. And to Sherry.
Yeah, you got to be careful of the handbook. If you look at the chapter on operational amplifiers in the handbook, year after year after year, the mathematics for the input impedance, I think it is, for a voltage follower, or the voltage gain calculation for a voltage follower, has an error. There's a one where there shouldn't be a one, and it's been there for years. So there are very few errors in the handbook, but it's not perfect. Nobody's asked about it. Don't shout in your mic, and go ahead, Howie.
No, sorry about it. Number one, first thing is this, that you, a quarter wave stub will work like a resonator. At frequency, it will be an open, and as you go to either side of frequency, you will start to change in impedance, and, you know, it'll start to come a short on either side. Second, Dick, as far as an RF, the reason why I think they don't use, you know, push-pull is that you would have to have a center tap and feed the voltage to both tubes, and then, you know, you would run into class AB. So I think they tend to use parallel in that sense. An audio amplifier, if you're right, you would have a transformer, and you would use the center tap of the transformer is where you would feed the B plus. But in an RF amplifier, that would be kind of complicated in the tuning if you were running a push-pull. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the so-called Plumber's Delight push-pull amplifier made out of, I think it's 3 or 4 inch diameter copper tubing, feeding a pair of 4CX250Bs on either 2 meters or 432. W1QXJ or something like that was the call letters of the guy in Massachusetts. A very popular rig in the mid-60s. It used push-pull. Link coupling on the input, link coupling on the output, push-pull everywhere. Popular rig, but a circuit that's a lot more complicated than it had to be compared to parallel. Also, it did a tuning with a plate that was on a lead screw, and the lead screw had full RF current flowing through the screw. And anybody at 432 who's ever run a power amplifier where the plate tuning capacitor has the RF current flowing through a screw that brings a metallic plate at right angles to it close or further away from the anode of the tube in order to tune, you'll notice that that's going to develop high current galling and welding effects if you ever do the tuning while the amplifier is running. And so the flapper capacitors that I started using and made a significant improvement along those lines when it comes to reliability and range of tuning. Another radical thing that amplifier of mine had is that it had a simple variable capacitor output coupling network, and that drove people crazy. And the fact that it was a strip line circuit with a flat resonator instead of a round resonator. All the good books were telling you get maximum Q with round. And various people were saying, gee, when you make it flat, it's not going to be as high a Q as round. That's what the good books were saying. Well, when you make a strip line that's 8 inches wide with 3-inch ground plane spacing, which easily can tolerate 40 kilowatts of power, when you build that kind of a circuit with strip line, it doesn't matter if it's round, square, triangle, or whatever. It's got a lot of hair on its chest, and the resonator itself runs ice cold. For a while, there were people blaming that amplifier for drifting, and to treat T-down conditions, the tuning of the plate circuit would drift. Well, you could press down the key as long as you want, make the amplifier as hot as you like, turn it off, open it up real fast, you'll find out the plate resonator is running ice cold. The thing that's doing the drifting is the tube itself. As your tube heats up, the screen grid inside gets hot, it grows larger in dimensions, it moves it closer to the plate, and the plate capacitance increases. So every tube amplifier, tetra tube type amplifiers, tends to tune itself lower in frequency as the tube gets hot. That's because of the screen grid growing, and I also got a theory that the ceramic insulator of the tube, as it gets hot, I think it changes dielectric constant, and again, it moves it in that direction. So 98% of the time, when you think you've got drifting of your amplifier, most of the time it's in the tube itself, not the resonating circuit that's connected to the tube. Okay, Mel, you better grab it real fast before somebody else does. K2KEY, K2RIW in the deck net.
Okay, this is KEY for us. Just make sure that nobody else wants to make a comment. All right, I'll make a couple of comments. First of all, I did not get the October issue of QSC, so I can't follow along on the article because I got to wait. I think somebody in the post office reads my magazine first. Let's see, interested in ham radio or whatever, making a cheap five magazine. So I wait until he's finished before I get it delivered. If you Basically, if you want to know the formula for the electrical length of a sub in degrees, it's X sub L equals Z sub zero tangent of bracket L sub T. That's the formula. I don't know what they have in the magazine there. You know, I'll have to wait until I get it, like I say, but that's basically the formula. I think is that what we're in controversy, Dick, over?
Yeah, I'm just grabbing the middle column of the article. I see X sub L equals Z0 tan L to B. Inductive reactance presented by a shorted stub less than quarter wavelength long as a function of the coaxial cable's characteristics using Z0 and electrical length of the sub in degrees L to B. He says X sub L equals Z0 tan L to B. I think he's got the formula correct. Similar capacitive reactance of an open sub less than quarter wave long is, he's duplicated the exact same formula twice. And so I guess it was Alan that brought that to our attention. Alan is right. The second formula should be arctan, the other kind of tangent. Why can't I think of it right now? You know what I mean. I think it's called not arctangent. Or is it arctangent? Yes, arctangent. But the one over tangent. The formula should be X sub D equals Z0, 1 over tangent, L sub D, and that's for an open circuited sub. And what is 1 over tangent called? It's not arctangent, that's an inverse tan. Or is it arctangent?
Oh. Tangent.
Okay. Looks like we eventually figured that one out. So, without a doubt, it looks like there is a mistake in the formula, and I'll bet you a zillion people are bringing it to their attention. Back to you, Bill.
Hey, you are talking about now capacitive reactance of an open stub. Is that what you're talking about? Quarter wave long? Is that what you're referring to, Dick? Over.
Roger. He used the exact same formula for an open circuit stub and a short circuit stub, and he should have changed the second formula when he talked about an open circuit stub, Bill. And they usually made quarter wavelength long or less. But if you want to, there's also, the formula still works if you make it longer than quarter wave. Once you decide you've got an open circuit stub and you use the 1 over tangent formula and you use a short circuit stub and you use the tangent formula, after that, the formula is correct for any length of stub, just that most people use a quarter wave or less. Now back to you, Mel.
Okay, you got it right. That's exactly 1 over tangent. That's what I'm going to say. If you're interested in the formula for a capacitive reactive stub, less than a quarter wavelength, or up to a quarter wavelength long. All right. Let me see. Push-pull. I've had a little bit of experience with push-pull amplifiers years ago. The pioneer work done on audio push-pull amplifiers was by a company called, the company for you, St. Williamson Amplifier. I wonder, first of all, did you ever hear of them, Dick, over?
Yes, I have heard of Williamson, but I don't remember very much about him right now.
Hey, he pioneered the push-pull. And basically, his experiment, because I got very fascinated with stereo, actually, binaural amplifiers originally. And I had built a Williamson-type amplifier. And because it was really touted. Do you remember radio electronics? They used to have a section in radio electronics every month for audio files. For golden ears. No, they called it for golden ears only. Do you remember that, Dick? Over.
No, Mel. That's before my time. I'm having fun with Mel. He and I were born the same month of the same year. That was before my time, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, no, it was in the 50s. Radio electronics, they had, I could say, monthly articles called Golden Ears Only, and it was different, amplifiers, tuners you could build, and all that goodie. And then they had the Williamson-type amplifier, and I remember reading quite a bit about push-pull. And he said that basically, he said he really looked into push-pull and came up with the idea, because he said, first push-pull circuits, the magnetizing effect of the plate current on the output tube in the transformer is reduced. And he also said that with push-pull, that the even harmonics of the input signal were basically by this type of circuit, allowing it to, at that time was the first time that became popular to run these tubes in class AB, Dick Over.
Didn't the Williamson amplifier, is that the one that also had a separate set of taps on the transformer for the screen grid? There was a kind of a push-pull audio amplifier, high efficiency, high dynamic range, or what's the word for it, low distortion type, where the outer winding of the transformer went to the plate, and a tap, two taps on that winding went to the screen grid. Was that the Williamson type Mel? Go ahead.
That was a feedback system there where they used the minus bias return, zero bias operation, and actually it was a minus bias system. You fool with me. That's exactly what it was doing.
Okay, and I think that that screen grid feedback also lowers the distortion of the tube or increases the linearity, and so Dyna, was that the name of the amplifier? Dyna was one of the really Stucci amplifiers in the late 50s, early 60s. Dynatech, Dyna something or other. 5880 push-pull tubes or something like that. I think it was a 100-watt-like audio amplifier that the hi-fi enthusiasts used to think was a cat's meow. I maybe don't remember the brand name, or is it Morant? I'm remembering some of these amplifiers. The good old days with tubes that would glow and produce some very nice round-sounding minor kinds of distortion out of your loudspeaker. And when transistorized amplifiers first came along and people weren't used to the kind of distortion they made, in the beginning people didn't like it until the guys with heavy metal started putting it to their advantage. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, this is H-A-Y. Yes, Dyna Kit. I was thinking about that was, wanted to put it together. Of course, Heathkit then jumped on it. Of course, Morant was around. Fisher. They were the big companies that were involved in producing, the early Monaro and then into the stereo equipment. And the Williamson amplifiers eventually went into a system. They originally went into push-pull class AB and then came out with their, when they came out with more sophisticated tubes, they eventually got into class 81, class 82, etc., supposedly improvement. Now, there was a manufacturer of transmitters, right, during World War II by Johnson. They built a transmitter, I remember this thing, using 4-250 tetros, and the output, the RF amplifier, was push-pull. Two link-coupled, they link-coupled the whole thing together, but they used a link-coupling on the output, fed the V-plus to center tap of the that coil, and had a butterfly capacitor to tube the two tubes, that was the end. Around, I guess they produced it around 44, 45. It was a 500-watt amplifier or something like that. Well, they called it a kilowatt amplifier. A pair of 4-250s without the X in it, Dick. Over.
Interesting. And what band did that amplifier go up to, Mel?
It was plug-in coil. That's the funny part of it. They produced it with a set of coils. It was used briefly, I think, by the military. I don't think it really became a popular amplifier, but there was a whole set of coils. It was an 8-chip amplifier, of course. I don't think that, let's put it this way, I don't believe they did anything above 20 meters. There was nothing I remember above, 20 meters conventional amplifiers of World War II. That was until later on, towards, I guess, the very end of the war. where, you know, especially the 2 meters, there was, you know, a couple of 2 meter pieces of equipment during World War II. Other than what was used in radar, there was the Mark II, the tank unit that had 80, 40, and 2 meters. All, I have one of those units. I just know it's something with the electric motors that tuned it. And, but of course, the 2 meter was a low power piece of equipment using the lighthouse to take over.
KF2RL. KF2RL recognized. I've got a question from Mel, but go ahead, RL.
Okay, name is Steve. I think you remember me. Actually, I designed the RF amplifier push-pull tube, and I struggled on the higher band, but solid state is normally push-pull because it's a much lower impedance, and it's a nice way of stepping up the impedance. As far as the tube amplifier you're talking about, Dynaco, I have a pair of those at home.
Yeah, that was a really stoochy amplifier in this day. Mel, that transmitter you had, that World War II transmitter, which had motors that would tune it, were you sometimes changing the frequency as to, and giving it a command to tune those motors by adjusting a rotary dial, telephone-type rotary dial? You would dial in a number? Is that the amplifier you're talking about?
Oh, no. No, no. You flip the switch. When you flip the switch to the appropriate band or whatever, you know, want to set it up, you set up the switches. And you heard the motors start up, and it was a real, you should have seen the wiring in this thing. Everything done mechanically. So you heard the motors start up in there, and it just changed all the settings. That's it. That's what changed the settings. They were preset. The motors went to these preset points, Dick, but you just snapped these switches to a positive snap. I mean, you had to have a good strong arm to turn some of those switches. They really snapped. And the thing was built literally so you can use a machine gun on it. They used to say, you know, it was built like a tank, but it was part of a tank. And you could rest the front end of your car on that radio, over.
How did the motors know how far to go? Were they connected to a potentiometer and a feedback network? Or was it a stepper motor? I don't think stepper motors had come into vogue yet. How did the motor know how many turns, Mel?
They were brush motors with a gearing block on each one of them. And it turned until it got to, let me tell you, the guy who figured this out really must have been a genius. It got to a certain point and it flipped a switch, a micro, well, I guess you can call it like, it was a set of contacts, something like a micro, an early version of what you would call a micro switch. It just turned this drum inside there that was connected to the gearbox. And so it hit that notch, and the switch would pop open and take over.
And hopefully the motor would glide just the right amount and stop in the right position?
Oh, they had the thing geared down with worm gears and all kinds of, I took apart a couple of gearboxes. It, you know, it was a positive torque. It had these springs in there. Wound around on the shaft, and I mean these springs were wound. You had to be careful. You didn't want one of them snapping off on you. It would fly out of there. You know, if anything comes flying out, it would kill you, this thing. Because they were wound tight. That was these motors drew a lot of current, because that was the anti-backlash system thing, so it was positive stopover.
See, one of the first things I worked on in the mid-60s was a surveillance receiver that went into something called the USD-7 aircraft, and it had a whole bunch of rods that had to be moved to tune the frequency. The rods were fed by synchronous motors or Stelson motors, and were three-phase windings, two-phase windings on them, or one-phase winding, and everything had to be wired just right for the tracking to take place. It's amazing how much electromechanical tuning was used on microwave circuits until the modern times when varactor diodes and other things came along. By modern day standards, wow, did they do it in a bulky, strong looking, but bulky technique, which purely mechanical devices have got all kinds of modes of failure that are, they got a wear out cycle, literally. Bearings wear out, gears wear out, gears get dry, lubrication disappears, and so all of the old-fashioned circuits, and you had to exercise them all the time, and you had to do preventive maintenance to keep them up to speed. Modern-day electronic circuits, I'd like to believe that the transmitter you're listening to right now, I could turn it off today, come back 10 years from now and turn it on, and hopefully it would work exactly the same way. Back to you, Mel.
This is Kate Roger. I think they've come a long way. Oh, yes, there was one other thing about, you know, right up, I think, at the end of World War II, with the availability of surplus and all, what gave those amplifiers, there was a couple of them produced that were very well constructed, those kilowatt amplifiers, the 4-250, and push-pull, was that they got a bad rap that they were causing them more TBI as, you know, the 40s really started to show television that it meant production and sales. These amplifiers, because they found that, I think, basically, the only thing I can think of, because they most likely had some reason that there was more harmonics coming out of these amplifiers than what became more popular, of course, was the Pi Network. Collins came up, of course, with the Pi Network configuration during World War II. I don't know, maybe he was in business with some coax manufacturer. Because that's when, of course, coax really took off during World War II. And they got away from the balanced output, using the link coupling balanced output. And that was where the claim was, that with the, of course, the Pi Network, reduced the amount of TBI problems, which was becoming really critical right after World War II, you know, in the 40s, late 40s, well, from 46, 47 or so, 48. So that was the end of the push-pull type of amplifier get over.
Comment? Okay, Lou will pick up with you in a second. And at least I think it's Lou. I'll go to Lou first. Go ahead, Lou.
Oh, in the 40s and 50s, we all used push-pull amplifiers. I started out in the late 40s with a pair of 809s, modulated with a pair of 46s. I bought it from an old guy who was retiring. It was my first transmitter. And crystal control. And after that, I had a pair of 8005s. They were push-pull also, modulated with 811. And, of course, the big VHF rig was the SCR-522, which was an 832, which is really a push-pull amplifier because it's two tetrodes in one bottle with all of about 16 or 18 watts output. And that thing had a tripler in it, and then it had a final push-pull. So it was almost exclusive until Collins 32V came out, 32V series, B1, B2, and B3, and the Johnson Viking 1, and then later the Viking 2, which all had single-ended tetrode amplifiers. The one that we couldn't get in the Korean War, it was, I can't remember the name of it, 4D32, 4 Delta 32, that was it. Go ahead, Dick.
Interesting, too. When it comes to that push-pull amplifier, though, Mel, I'm having trouble believing that it was the harmonics creating the TBI. When you're running a kilowatt in the late 40s on any band, and there's a local television set, and those television sets in those days didn't have anywhere near the sharpness and tuning of the front end. Some of them, like the RCA 630 and the Philco turret tuner, there wasn't a whole lot of fancy tuning and shielding in those front ends. So front end overload, in my opinion, was very easy to happen. So I think that amplifier created TBI simply because it was the Don Sprong and simply created front end overload for a couple of blocks around you. But here's a question for you, Mel. I remember watching a Howdy Doody show, late 1947, 48 time frame, and Buffalo Bob was holding up this piece of coaxial cable, and for quite a few days or quite a few weeks, everybody was looking forward to the coaxial cable that was going to convey the signal across the United States. We're all looking forward to that coaxial cable. I think the day came when they finally had the coaxial cable in operation. And I guess in theory, California could talk to New York and vice versa. I'm having trouble believing that it really requires a coaxial cable with a zillion amplifiers going all the way across the United States as opposed to a microwave link. I have a sneaky suspicion the coaxial cable conveys the signal up each one of the towers to the Hoghorn antenna, and on S-band linking with 30-mile hops between with the Mom Bell system. That's how the signal got there. I'm having a lot of trouble believing there really was a coaxial cable going 3,000 miles across the United States. But I wonder if you remember that incident. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Now, this is K2KEY. I remember it. I remember the whole thing, but it's sort of, you know, kind of dim in my memory. Yeah, I would question that, that they ran a 3,000. That was NBC. NBC claimed that, I think they were making claims that they had the country east of the west, you know, where this was their equivalent of joining of the Intercontinental Railroad. Now we have the Intercontinental coaxial cable, but that's, you know, questionable thing. And Lou is right, the Johnson Viking 2 came out with the 4032 single-ended final amplifier. Collins did produce a number of those rings of 32. However, Johnson then went over. The Viking 1 also got a bad name because there was a lot of TDI, and they redesigned the Viking 1 to the Viking 2. And what they went to is a pair of tubes. They did away with the 4032, and they went to a new tube that had just come on the market by RCA called 6146. And they used two 6146 in the Viking 2, John's Viking 2. You remember that, Lou? Over.
Yeah, I sure do. I forgot about that. Yeah. I had the Viking 1, and it sure did generate TDI. I had a big low-pass filter strapped on the back of it, or right by the back of it. And it helped some, but it didn't get rid of it. Go ahead.
Okay, and then of course Viking 2 was a whole redesign. Remember they shielded, they put a big copper copper plated panel in there between the front controls and set through the shaft. Put a nice cover around the meters. Oh, everything that means that copper plated the entire inside of the cabinet. Imagine that, whole copper plated inside of the cabinet, and put a lid on it with a bunch of these little copper strips, finger strips, so that top cabinet, part of the cabinet really locked down. In fact, I took out my Viking 2, which is the one I put on here. Every year when we have the Great Key Night, the FKN Great Key Night, we all get on with our vintage radios, and that's the radio I run on CW on once a year December 31st. That's our straight key night every year. Everybody running straight keys at the old radio. Okay, so that's basically, you know, one and on about the push-pulls and all this kind of stuff in the history of it. It's very interesting, you know, how we progressed along the line and how we still use, I could say, push-pull is still available and still works quite well in certain circuitry, but of course, in the modern linear amplifiers, the two types of modern linear amplifiers, of course, we've got the parallel type tubes, much simpler design with PI networks. Okay, I think any other questions about it, or anybody want to ask anything about it before we go ahead?
I'm going to ask something more about push-pull. Arguably, when it comes to high-power 900 megacycle amplifiers, a cell phone service in particular, 880 megacycle type stuff. If you look up the Motorola transistor, MRF-899, mic radio frequency 899, that is a 150-watt transistor, 9 dB of gain, 150 watts of output. And it really is two transistors in one package intended for push-pull service. So there are probably, I'm trying to make an estimation, there may be a million of those things in operation right now, those transistors themselves. Because in a particular 600-watt amplifier that's very popular, four of them are in the final stage. Four push-pull stages. you could say a total of eight real transistors. You've got four packages because there's a double transistor in each package. So here we are in the year 2000, still making very heavy use of push-pull. In the case of that solid-state circuit, the main advantage you get is that it's suppressing the even harmonics, and when it comes to a solid-state circuit running on 24 volts and you're drawing 45 amperes into that amplifier, you'd really like not want to draw 45 amps with all transistors simultaneously. The nice thing about push-pull is that you're alternating which one is drawing current during which period of time, and therefore the amount of bypassing capacitance and the inductance, the stray inductance that you can tolerate in the bypass capacitance, gets a hell of a lot easier in that solid-state amplifier with push-pull. So, although when it comes to tube circuits, I'm a strong advocate of parallel, there's a place where push-pull in transistor high-power circuits has a lot going for it. So, when you study the schematic, and that's about a 10-page data sheet, all you have to do is go to Google and search on MRF-899, and you get a beautiful PDF data sheet on that very popular Motorola transistor. And it is push-pull in its recommended circuit. Back to you, Mel.
KF2L.
Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, I've designed several solid-state amplifiers in my day. One of the nice things about push-pull is you take, a 50-ohm system, go through the balun, and you can think of it as two series 25-ohm source impedances in series.
There's another huge advantage you get when it comes to combining amplifiers. When you've got two transistors in the same amplifier, or even if each individual stage is running push-pull, but you want a total of two of those stages, if you combine them and separate them by way of quadrature hybrids, you come up with a huge advantage when it comes to input impedance and output impedance. Properly set up quadrature hybrids on so-called balanced amplifiers can take the ugliest amplifier, which has got a VISWR of 10 to 1, and you hook up that quadrature hybrid on the input and quadrature hybrid on the output. You will measure an input impedance of 50 ohms over a huge frequency range and an output impedance of 50 ohms over a huge frequency range. It's the so-called Kurokawa amplifier, popularly called balanced amplifier. I bet you've used a few of those in your time. And using that quadrature amplifier technique, that's involved in some of my antenna patents, would you believe? Back to you, Steve.
Okay, there's another advantage, actually, besides that, with the 90-degree combining. If you have equal impedances, they do cancel out. Also, if you're multiple octaves, the third harmonics actually cancel out also. But with the balun, with the one-to-one balun, with the solid-state amplifiers, you're dealing with transistors with very low impedance, normally a couple of ohms. The 899 is, I think it's 150 watts of PEP. Doesn't do with CW, by the way. And you'll see, typically they'll use like a 4-to-1 transformer with a 50-ohm balun, or maybe even 9-to-1 at that power level. And the 50-ohm balun, you know, the 1-to-1 balun, actually takes 50 ohms and makes it 225 ohms in series. So it actually helps your impedance matching.
I believe that. By the way, the 899, when you study the data sheet, it doesn't say it can only be used in peak envelope power of 150 watts. They rate the third order intermodulation distortion in that mode, and it's like minus 32 dB. But you put a big enough heat sink on that, you will get 150 watts out of that forever key down. I have done it. And I did it as early as 1 week ago. Back to you, Steve.
Okay. Well, I was dealing with systems that were for military, and actually the 899 had too high JC between the case and the junction, and I couldn't do it with the temperature it was operating at. I ended up using something else.
Okay. I think in your case, you probably had to operate with a heat sink temperature that went to 100 degrees C, and your mil-spec probably told you to keep the junction temperature below 150 C in order to get reliability. Therefore, under those conditions, you couldn't get there from here. But if you've got a big enough chunk of aluminum with enough air going past the aluminum, and you've got the heat sink running closer to 25 degrees C, I think there's nothing stopping you from running that transistor key down 150 watts output. I'd like to use the